I often feel quite happy or joyful when I come and sit here and come here. I'm feeling kind of happy to be here today, sitting quietly. Can you hear me okay in the back? Okay. Speak a little bit louder. However, what I thought I would talk about today is anger. Anger is a very common feeling that people have, and it's also one of the more common emotions that people will ask about when they talk about how to apply or bring their mindfulness to their emotional lives. The two big emotions that people will be most interested in asking about is anger or fear. And I don't know which is most popular. But today I thought I would talk about anger. Partly because it's an important emotion, but partly because it's an emotion which, I just use it as an example perhaps, of how we apply the practice to our emotional lives. And some of what I'll say today applies and maybe primarily to what we do in the sitting practice, and some of it applies to bring mindfulness into our daily lives. One of the great advantages or beauties about developing mindfulness of our lives in meditation practice is that it's very clear that as you sit and meditate, you don't have to act and do anything. You know, so you can be furious at someone in meditation. And the dilemma about whether at that moment you're supposed to yell at them or punch them out or, you know, do anything at all about it isn't a pertinent issue, because in the moment you're committed to just sitting there. And so freed up from the need to make a decision, we can actually more fully, completely feel the experience of anger in a way that probably we wouldn't feel it so fully if we were struggling with the decision about how to act on it, or even if we were deciding to act on it. So, as most of you know, I have this newborn son at home, and it's interesting to watch the range of his emotions as he go through the day or through the weeks. He spends a lot of time smiling if we're interacting with him. And he's kind of a clean channel for the most part for his emotions. And sometimes he just looks at you full on, eyes straight at your eyes, and just smiles and laughs and smiles. And sometimes he does this thing that looks like shyness. I don't know what that, if it is that, but he smiles and then he immediately goes like this. And then he looks and he smiles and then he goes like this. But also he can express something which looks to me like anger. Though I mentioned that one night, I think maybe here or Monday night, and one of the students here got on my case a little bit for too quickly interpreting what I saw as being anger, as if that was an interpretation that was adding on top of his experience. And maybe it was so. I do know that what he was expressing was intense. Well, if it wasn't anger, I don't know, I was going to say it was ferocious. And it certainly wasn't inhibited. It was some expression of tremendous, maybe irritation is a fair enough interpretation of what's going on there. He's really irritated. Something is wrong. And he's really kind of expressing that something is really wrong. And he just, his eyes are kind of zeroing in on my eyes and just looking kind of like great lasers and saying, you know, and his face kind of turns into this ugly pucker and his, you know, and his whole face kind of, he has this wonderful, beautiful, angelic face, except when he has this intensity, ferocity or whatever, and it's just like demonic, which is also an interpretation. But, you know, I'm trying to convey that there's a certain intensity to it. And, if, you know, most of us, if we saw that kind of face in an adult looking at us in that kind of way, most of us would say, well, this person's angry with me. But I don't know what he's feeling. But it happens when something in his universe is wrong. Something is making him uncomfortable. He's hungry, or he's sleepy, or his diapers need to be changed, or something is really disturbing him, is troubling him in a physical way. This intense response recurs. And one of the beautiful things about it is that it doesn't seem to be inhibited in any way. It's just there as this pure expression of energy, of a pure expression of feelings or whatever. And it's quite effective, whether it's his intention or not, or whether it's probably the genetic intention, that it gets his parents' attention. And it's a form of communication where something happens and the conditions get improved for him pretty quickly. So it's very effective. It has a great purpose for getting what he needs to be taken care of. And what I suspect will happen as he gets older, at some point he'll have toys and be playing with other kids, and his toy will be taken by the other kid, and the other kid will be playing with it, and he'll get angry. And it'll be a very different kind of anger than the first type. Now it's just, you know, I'm uncomfortable in my wet diapers, you know. But now, in the future, it's going to be, you know, I'm feeling distress because this person has what I think is mine. And then he's going to be a little bit older, and someone's going to call him a dirty name. Your father wears army boots. And so he's going to get, you know, riled up around that and get angry at that kind of expression. And then he's going to get older, and he's going out with some person, and some other person starts going out with that person, and he gets angry because he's lost his partner or something. And then, you know, he gets older, and someone, puts a scratch, bumps into his car. You know, he gets angry. And then someone else, it goes on and on, right? I mean, and what I'm trying to convey, not so successfully, is that the kind of things that we get angry with changes as we get older and older, as we get more developed and mature. We have a greater sense of self, a greater sense of what we identify with, a greater sense of what causes a discomfort to ourselves. But as we get older, often the sources of discomfort is not that stimulates anger, or this kind of intensity, this ferocity or whatever, is not some physical discomfort in the world, but it often has a psychological base. The fact that someone scratches my car, the intensity of my feelings depends a lot on whether I'm having to drive that old beat-up car or that brand new car of mine. A beat-up old car that I used to have, who cares? One more scratch. But this new car that I have, it has great consequence. And, it's a psychological world of newness and oldness, and it doesn't have any real bearing on my own direct well-being. It's kind of my indirect well-being, by what I identify with, my sources of happiness, my sources of identification. And it can get quite complicated, what stimulates a sense of distress that causes something like anger. And usually anger, or this can arise, or this intensity of arises when there's some kind of discomfort in our system, when we're feeling discomforted. Or as adults, sometimes it's fear, sometimes it's a sense of hurt, but something is wrong, and we're stimulated to do something about it. It's this ferocity, this energy, kind of gets born within us. Another thing that happens, however, as we're getting older, is that we start incorporating within ourselves all kinds of messages about, from our society, from our family, about the rules of the game around anger. My little son now, he has no rules. If he's angry, it just, you know, he hasn't learned that in certain settings you're not supposed to be angry. Certain people you're not supposed to be angry. He hasn't learned that to your father you're not supposed to be angry. You know, or whatever it happens in some families. You know, he doesn't know, he just... But as we get older, we'll learn these things. We shouldn't be angry to our boss. You know, we shouldn't be angry to our girlfriend or our boyfriend. Or maybe we don't learn it so much, but we kind of get afraid that if we express it, that there's going to be consequences that we can't handle, we don't want to see. And so we tend then to have all these complicated relationships to our anger. It's inappropriate to express it in some times. It's appropriate at other times. It's It's embarrassing, it's frightening, it's many things we feel. And it gets very complicated, you know. And the whole ecology of anger is really fascinating, and it's many forms it takes in the world. Many of us take our anger very personally, not recognizing that much of it exists in a field of communication, a field of relationships, and that the field of relationship can be quite complicated. So, for example, our society is in part, it's many things, but our society is in part tends to evoke a lot of anger in some people. I think often minorities, minorities or subordinate types in companies or in society, tend to be in situations where they're not respected as much as the dominant majority or the dominant kind of bosses in the corporation or whatever. And the disrespect they get, or the discounting they get, or the ill treatment they might get, causes discomfort and distress, which often then will manifest itself or show itself up in anger or some kind of ferocity. But if you're a subordinate type in our culture, to express anger just gets more, the consequences are often bad. So society tends to evoke sometimes anger in people, but if you express it, then something's wrong with you, not with the people causing the anger-provoking stuff. Does it make sense? So it's very complicated, the nexus, the ecology of things of anger. And as we get older, it gets more and more complicated. And as it gets more complicated, the pure expression of it, the pure channel that we're capable of being, begins being inhibited or slowed down or channeled in new ways. And one of the more dramatic ways is it gets repressed. Anger is inappropriate to express. You're wrong for expressing it. Something's wrong, terrible with you, and it's inappropriate. So let's repress it. Let's hide it. And that's one of the complicated ways we respond to it. Another complicated relationship is the expression of anger ties into our identity in various ways. One person recently told me that she really loved her anger in a particular setting because she felt she had a lot of power. And she usually felt powerless, and feeling that power made her really feel alive and good and healthy in some ways. And so the anger was being used not as an expression of something, you know, communication of a need, but rather she was hanging on to the anger because she felt generally, usually kind of didn't feel her own power, and this was a chance to hang on to it for a while. Or people who sometimes in some societies or some areas, the expression of anger is considered to be an appropriate macho thing to do. Or some families, love is expressed through anger. That's the only way you have kind of intense contact with a fellow family member is if you kind of are angry with each other. And it can, and because we want often to have contact with each other, if it's not coming any other way, in some family dynamics, then angry behavior gets self-perpetuated and has other purposes besides expressing, hey, wait a minute, there's a problem here. So anger gets complicated, both in our relationship as we get older and older. One of the opportunities that exists by doing simple meditation practice is that it's possible to learn how to be present for anger without all the complicated ideas we have about it, without censoring it, without judging it, without feeling that you're wrong for having it, without justifying it, without feeling now you're really great because you have it or whatever. But just the energy, the feeling, the sensation of anger can just be there in this very direct, I don't know if pure is the right word, but kind of pure sensory level, energetic level. And it can be quite something to sit down and be sitting in posture like this or sitting in a chair and say, okay, I'm going to open myself fully and let this anger that I have really have its time in the sun, have its time in the light. Just let it really be there, and I'm going to really feel what it's like to be a human being who's angry without any ideas of, you know, what it means to be angry or what's right or what's wrong. And that's a big part, I think, of what mindfulness practice can offer us, is this ability to feel our experience directly without all the complications that we add onto it. And this is, I think, one of the really beautiful things about this kind of practice, is having, there's very few places in our life where we give ourselves that kind of permission, this kind of unconditional permission to really feel what's going on for us without adding things on top of it. And it becomes a great source of help in our normal life also, because as we get a sense of it in this corner of our life, we then start developing a different relationship to our emotions, to our anger, when we go back into our normal life where things are more complicated, for sure. But you start learning, oh, maybe it's okay to open to it. I don't have to be so afraid of it. We learn how to handle it, how to be present for it, how to learn from it, rather than be the victims of it or controlled by it. So that's one of the great things about this practice, is just feel it, just be with it. And as non-judgmental stance for our feelings, for our anger. In addition, as we kind of can allow our anger to be there in a full way, in a pure way, just feeling the sensory levels, just sensation of it, if there is no judgment or no complications with it, no justification of it, no fueling it with more stories about who did what to who, but just really feeling it as it is in the present moment, it tends to take a different course. It tends to soften, it tends to unravel itself much more quickly than if we're riding on top of it and planning our vendetta. You know, if we're planning how to, or justifying ourselves, or constantly harping over the hurt that might have caused it. It tends to have a different life. But more interesting, more important, is once we kind of allow it to be there in this free way, that it allows us also to understand it better, to investigate it better. And this is actually one of the pieces of a very important part of mindfulness practice, is investigation. What is this animal? What is this experience of anger? Once I allow it to be there without judging it, how can I experience it? How can I feel it? What is it? And it's a number of different things. One of the things I think it is, this is my opinion, I'll tell you. My opinion about anger is that anger is always a symptom or a sign that there's something wrong. And it's best to take anger as kind of a healthy sign that something is wrong, rather than thinking that anger is a problem. It's like a flag. It says, hey, you dummy. You haven't noticed, but there's something wrong here. There's some distress, there's some hurt, there's some fear, there's something going on that needs your attending to. So in that sense, anger becomes your friend, because, you know, rather than your enemy or your problem. It's a healthy way of saying something's a problem here. You should pay attention to it. So what are some of the things? So what are some of the... So I'm talking about anger itself. Now, one of the things we did also discover is that anger is closely connected, closely related to a lot of other emotions, similar kind of emotions that sometimes look like anger, but are not really anger. And some of the discussions we have often here about anger and when is anger appropriate, and could be simplified, I think, quite a bit if we can distinguish between these little animals, that are species that are so closely connected to each other that they mask for each other. One of them is hostility. I think a lot of people don't often see the difference between anger and hostility, and whether anger is mixed with hostility. And so the question, is anger ever appropriate, could be reworded, and we can say, is hostility ever appropriate? And I think if the question is put that way, I think we'll have a different relationship to the issue than if we say, is anger appropriate? Hostility, as I understand it, is acting on feelings of aversion, or acting out of feelings of ill will, or acting on feelings of anger that we might have. It's wanting to attack something else, some person out there, or inside, or sometimes we're hostile towards ourselves. It's some kind of attack that goes on. And I don't think it's ever appropriate, unless it's really to defend oneself. But defense is not hostility, is it? I don't think a defensive act is a hostile act. So I don't think it's ever really appropriate to be hostile. But to bring the teasing apart, the degree to which our anger might be hostile and the degree to which it's just anger at the situation, I think is very important. And as we hang out with our anger, we can maybe begin teasing apart the intention that seems to come with that anger. And if the intention is hostile, for vengeance or revenge or to, make fun of someone or whatever it might be, then we can maybe, if we see the difference between that, maybe we can take more responsibility for those feelings of hostility. The other close species to anger is resentment, which is often, can be mistaken for it. And resentment is also not anger. It's connected to anger in that resentment is frozen anger, anger which has gotten stuck. And I think it's resentment is kind of like a great poison, because it's this kind of stuck, frozen, tense place inside of us that keeps burning and burning and burning, sometimes decades after the event has occurred. When there's resentment, there's a complicated relationship that's formed towards the anger or towards the hurt that causes the anger. So if you start seeing the difference between hostility on one side and resentment on the other, then we can see that in the middle, perhaps, there's the expression of anger that doesn't have to have either one of those in it. And it's possible to experience the anger in a much purer way, in a simpler way, direct way. And then the question is, how can we be with that? What can we learn from it? What is being communicated? What is the purpose of that expression of anger? Is it like my little son, where it's really an expression that something is wrong in the universe, something is distressing, there's some suffering here that needs some attention to? So then the question is, what is that force of distress? What's stimulating the anger? And it could be a whole range of things. Sometimes this strong ferocity, strong energy of irritation, of something is wrong here, of anger, can arise as kind of a protective mechanism, that there's a real and genuine threat to ourselves, and we're kind of rallying our energy and forces to try to meet that threat. It could be a threat to our identity, a threat to our physical well-being. Sometimes it can be a threat to our integrity, but sometimes it can be a threat to our ego. And some of you might have noticed that your integrity and your ego are not necessarily the same thing. And our ego has a lot to do with how we want other people to see us, or the idea of how we want to see ourselves. I was give you a personal example, and maybe it doesn't relate so much to today, but you'll be forgiving, hopefully. I was running up where I live, and I live up in Skyline, there's really no neighbors. I live in an open space preserve up there, and there's all these miles of trails that lead from our driveway, and a lot of mountain bikers use that particular preserve. It's very popular for mountain bikers. And yesterday I was running, and there's a very nice kind of more or less flat running trail that goes about a mile in each direction from our driveway. And it's not a big deal to run that mile back and forth, especially since it's kind of flat. And I was running back, and the trail crosses another trail, and these two mountain bikers were crisscrossing my path. And this thought went through my mind. Oh, I hope they notice that I'm running up here in the middle of nowhere. They're probably thinking that I've been running for hours, because there's no houses up here and hardly at all. And they must, hopefully they see that I'm a really great marathon runner. I hope they don't stop and ask me, where I live, because I have to tell them I live just around the corner there. And I could just see this thought going through my mind. It lasted about 2 seconds. And there was nothing in me that grabbed onto those thoughts. There was no hooks. There was not like, But what often happens is we grab onto those thoughts, right? We hook onto them and then, it's like this whole story we're making. And, it gets worse and worse. But luckily, at that particular moment, I could just kind of see those thoughts kind of passing through like clouds in an empty sky. So I was saved a lot of grief. But my ego somehow, or some egotistical thoughts had occurred. And there, if I had hooked onto them, they could have been threatened. And then if they had been threatened, I could have gotten angry, because it wasn't my integrity or my basic self that was being threatened, but it was this little hook of idea of this is how I have to be to present myself so I get people's praise and whatever. And if anger arises for that purpose, it's very different than if it's a real kind of physical or integrity-threatening threat. But even if it's a threat to our ego, it'd be very easy to judge that and say, oh, that's wrong and that's bad. You know, uh-oh, I can't do that. But I think in Buddhism, in Buddhist practice, we want to actually respect everything and not discount anything. And if it is from our ego, the ego itself tends to arise oftentimes from some place of suffering, a deeper place, a real felt sense place of suffering, a feeling of vulnerability, a feeling of inadequacy, a feeling of hurt, a feeling of whatever. Some feeling that's deeper than the ego itself. The ego is often an expression of something deeper. So then we kind of learn to investigate what is actually going on here. What's the actual source of suffering that seems to be the root of this experience of anger? And to do that is to really respect anger, I believe, is to really use anger for its real purpose. Its purpose of anger is not to be hostile towards someone else. The purpose of anger is not to be hostile towards oneself or to feel guilty. But rather the purpose of anger is to tell you there's some problem that needs some addressing. And so the question is, what is that and what is the appropriate response? And so many of us, for adults, it's not immediate life-threatening situations where, you know, a mountain lion's about to attack your baby and you better, you know, generate all the energy you can and fury you can to kind of stop it. You know, it's, you know, an office worker who didn't say hello to you that morning and hasn't said hello to you all week. And, you know, you feel kind of like discounted. You know, and feeling of being discounted feels bad, and you get angry. There's actually much more complicated things. It doesn't require us to kind of jump up all the ferocity we have to kind of attack that fellow office worker and protect ourselves. So the purpose of anger in most of our adult situations, I think, is to inform us that there's some problem. And then we should learn how to investigate the real source of the problem, to translate the anger into hostility, where the focus of the anger is external, often takes us away from really where the distress or the problem really is, if we're the one who's angry. This works in reverse fashion also. It's very interesting. When someone else gets angry, for example, at you, the mindfulness practice can help, because one of the things you can learn to do is to be okay being the recipient of anger. What do you think of that? What's harder? To be okay about yourself being angry, or to be okay about being the recipient of someone's anger? I think for some people the latter is more difficult. So to be the recipient, to feel the anger from someone else being directed at you, is very threatening. But again, in our adult life, in the moment, most situations where someone's angry at you, they're not about to pounce on you, sometimes maybe, but they're not about to tear you apart. And, they're just kind of letting you know something. And what is it possible to just kind of receive that and allow that, the feelings, sensations inside of you that occur in response to it, to allow that to be there in its free and open, pure way, it's just sensation energy, as you would when you're feeling anger when you're sitting in meditation. It is possible. And it's a tremendous gift to your friends and your society to be able to do that. At some point recently, someone was furious at me. This actually happens periodically. it partly has to do a little bit with the role that I have. This is a complicated role, to be a meditation teacher. And the role comes with a certain amount of, it's not inappropriate, but it makes things complicated. A certain amount of transference projections, some idealization about who I am. And as soon as someone is idealized, the cards are set up for that person to be, you know, not live up to that ideal, and that sometimes causes anger for people. Or, you know, so sometimes I'm the recipient of anger. And I've sat there and just received anger, and just, you know, quite ferocious, the person will come back a couple of days later and just thank me so much that they never had the experience of their life of someone who didn't run away or attack when they were angry at the person, and that it really helped them to feel more comfortable and not be frightened by their own anger and by their own discomfort, it really helped them to feel that maybe the world was a more trustable place than they realized. And it was very helpful for that person just to feel that someone is not going to attack them in return. It doesn't mean that I'm kind of like a pushover. It doesn't mean that I'm kind of being weak. I think it's actually a sign of strength to sit there and receive the anger without either wilting or getting angry in return or getting all tense, but simply to be there and just feel it like it's a wind passing through you. And it's not a comfortable wind, but that's okay. That's one of the things we learn through the meditation practice, to learn how to be okay, in a sense, with uncomfortable feelings. If we don't learn how to be comfortable with uncomfortable feelings, that is when we start reacting unwisely to the world around us. It's very powerful to learn how to be comfortable. When someone's angry at you, it's the same kind of investigation. You can say, well, this person's angry. I don't like it. You don't have to like it to be an open channel to it. I don't like it. But this is also a symptom that there's some suffering, some distress here. The person's not going to be angry at me unless the anger is being stimulated by some distress within the person. And if we then start listening, what is the distress that anger is trying to communicate? The person will often be very grateful if you begin listening to the deeper source of their distress than if you're listening to the anger. I've been also in situations where people are being angry, sometimes at me or sometimes just angry in general. And you make a very simple, sincere reference to the fact that you can appreciate that they're afraid or appreciate that there's real hurt there. And suddenly the conversation will change radically because they feel that they've been seen and heard. And you've kind of moved the conversation to a deeper level, to the source, rather than to the projected object of the problem. Does that make sense? So this principle that anger is always communicating something useful is helpful, I think, in interpersonal relationships too. It's very helpful for close relationships, intimate relationships, because it means that when the person's angry with you in an intimate relationship, they might be projecting on you or angry at you for wrong reasons. You didn't do anything at all. But there's still some distress in the universe. And to be able to address and meet the other person and work out where the distress is very helpful, even if the person's crazy. I mean, not crazy, but even if the person is, a little bit, off the wall. We don't want to discount anyone. We don't want to discount anything. What we really want to do is to meet the person where they're really at and together begin clarifying the situation, the relationship, at the deeper and deeper levels of what it is. And if we react to the anger with anger, we're not really allowing ourselves often to kind of see the deeper roots of it and really help make our connection, our relationship connect in a deeper way. Yes.
Using you as a whipping post, and I don't think it's necessarily.
Well, they're using you. They're using you for they're being hostile then.
Well, there's still hurt there though, and they're not. They're taking out their anger on you.
Yes, which is hostile. They're acting on their hurt perhaps, and taking it out on other people. Yes, that happens. And if there is real threat, I think it's appropriate to defend ourselves. It's appropriate to do something. It's appropriate to respond wisely. If the situation allows for it. But we have to be very sensitive. And if we really understand the wider picture of what's going on, sometimes our response can be quite different than if we just kind of look at this particular event. For example, if we have some strong ego of our own, and then we're getting attacked in a way that's really threatening, but we get confused and also think that our ego is being attacked and we want to defend our ego, the whole thing gets very messy very quickly. So how do we defend ourselves? How do we respond appropriately without kind of having to do it in order to preserve our pride or preserve our identity or something?
Well, like, my department handles complaints. And when you'll get somebody in the town hospital and you'll get people that, they've been passed along for 20 times and I'll truly be trying to solve the problem for them, but they're so angry at that point that, they're calling me names, and I can take a a bit of that, but after a while, it's like, hey, you know, I'm trying to help. Shut up.
Yeah.
Or it becomes, there's an abusive point to it.
An abusive point. But I agree. And I think one of the things we have to be very, very wise and compassionate about is what our own limitations are. So if you really feel like I'm sinking here, then it might be very appropriate to say, you know, shut up, you know, and say it, you know, so ferociously that the whole building kind of shakes, and you really got that person's attention. They're stunned, and they go, okay. Maybe that's appropriate sometimes if you really feel. However, what we want to be very careful with is not to confuse our personal distress, what's happening to us, with the other person being the cause for our distress. They're the condition for it. If someone's yelling at me, you know, your father wears army boots. I bet now, as an adult now, you can say that to me as much as you wish, as strongly as you wish, and I might get bored. But it's not going to have much charge for me. That if I did have a charge from it, and I felt really hurt because my identity, my ego is tied up with having a certain kind of father who wears only Birkenstocks. Then I want to be very careful. I want to be very careful not to say that that person is abusing me, when part of my distress has really had to do with my ego identity. This is a very delicate thing I'm saying here, because there are situations of real abuse. So I don't want to discount abuse, but we want to be careful with that label. Because often what we do is there is a condition. People are doing things which are uncomfortable producing. So that's definitely uncomfortable. But the degree in which we start feeling kind of terrible around it, and we want to kind of react, is often have to do with the inner ecology of our stuff. Now we have to take that very serious and respect it. And if we need to, kind of put very strong boundaries down, say enough. But I would imagine that your job, I mean, I wouldn't want to be in your job, and I sincerely think that probably you can handle better than me at this point, with your experience there in that place. I have a lot of respect for what you do. But I also feel, I mean, in addition, what I feel is that it's a fantastic meditation hall. you couldn't design maybe a better meditation hall. To be there, you know, day after day, and these people who are irate coming at you, and you just breathe. And you try to handle it really responsibly, take care of it properly, and study the difference between when you can do it and when you can't. What are the elements that come together that 1/1000th of a time that you can do it? Give yourself a lot of credit for that 1/1000th of a time, and get a sense, feel what that's like. Learn to appreciate that when it does occur.
Well, it makes sense to me that, I mean, I'm angry so much during the day, but it usually is because there's something going on that needs fixing, but it becomes absurd how many things are wrong, that it becomes really hard to not get like this gnawing ball that becomes really unpleasant and difficult to sit with.
Right. Exactly. I think so. And then, so this is where, again, we're realizing what's happening for us is so important. And if we feel like things are getting out of hand, that we're drowning in a tight tension or whatever, if we have enough clarity to see that, then sometimes we can decide, well, I can't continue this way. I better take a breather. I better go sit and meditate for a little while and try to clear out. Or to have... I mean, imagine what it's like for some people who have no way of clearing out. And so the tensions of their lives build and build from day to day and day until they finally explode. You know, we have at least the opportunity to sit every day, for those of you who do. And sitting is extremely powerful for creating some balance and some clarity for our life, which can be quite intense. And it's a fantastic resource to bring bring it into our life, a daily sitting.
I noticed that while you're giving this talk, I'm feeling like sort of falling over, you know, just kind of like, and my attention is having a hard time staying on what you're talking about. So I'm thinking this must have something to do with me, you know, this repression and all that kind of stuff.
Let me ask you a question. You've been coming here for a long time, listening to me for a long time. So you have a long history to compare with. Is it pretty unusual for you to kind of feel what you're feeling tonight?
Yeah.
So it's not because I could easily imagine someone being bored by me, you know, or not interested or whatever, you know, whatever. So I just wanted to check, but see that's not. So.
I think that's what's happening.
So just checking. It's great, but then you were interpreting it. You said your symptoms and your interpretation was it must mean something to do with me. And so I was just checking, making sure I wasn't just kind of boring you all today. So that's very, very, very important symptoms to study and learn from. And the fact that you brought it up, you noticed it and then brought it up, is exactly what we're supposed to be doing in our practice. And wait a minute, something here is wrong. And let me become conscious of what's going on here. I'm kind of not paying attention. Why? And maybe you're bored by me. That's interesting to know. I mean, that's interesting to know. That's interesting information to know. Or it could be that it's threatening, or it's frightening, or it has implications that are difficult, and that's also interesting to know.
I think she found out what down at West Almond.
When we come back, take this question, we'll come back to you. Why don't you sit with it, and if you want to say something else. Yes?
A comment for a number of us that enjoy Buddhism to help in dealing with very troublesome customers. And, you know, is to, as you, I think, indicated, the opportunity to be in a job where you see Buddhas every day come to you, stress you. And all of these people are opportunities trying to teach you. They're very intelligent people, really. They're all Buddhas. They're trying to bend you in different ways. And it's a wonderful opportunity. You get a chance to practice with different Buddhas continually.
Yeah, they're coming and bringing you exactly what you need.
And the problem of dealing with many, many, many problems, some of the things that we do is find one good thing that you do during that day and really reflect on that one thing that you solved. And then you write it down on your computer screen and say, wow, you really did that, just that one. And it may help to block out some of the other challenges from the other Buddhists.
Yes.
One question in reading on anger, there are some readings that had a format for dealing with anger that related to deciding if it is true or not true, and then if you can do something about it or not do something about it as a decision matrix. Have you read that? Or are you familiar with that teaching?
I don't know. What interests me is I'm reluctant to use the kind of language of true and not true, because in the moment of feeling the experience of anger, it's a true experience. The judgments or the projection that it involves might be true or not true, but the experience itself is true, and that's all I need to know. And then what I'll do is I'll step back behind it and say, what is the fear or the hurt that stimulated it? And is that based on a true or false interpretation? But the feeling of hurt is real. And then what I keep doing is trying to study what's the real experience in the situation. And as long as I can stay in touch with the real experience, I'm actually reluctant to discount the feeling based on whether the content is true or false. Does that make sense? So, get back to you. Because it was quite wonderful that you spoke up and what you felt. And do you have anything else you want to say about it, or anything else that occurs to you?
Well, there have been people in my life who've gotten really angry, I guess, and really frightened me as a child.
This might be too difficult to reconstruct, but can you remember, was a certain point in the discourse, in the discussion today, where you checked out? Do you remember?
Well, I noticed when you used that word repression, that I started feeling sort of like I was going to go boing. I felt kind of wavery, you know? I guess I don't know what the next step is, being that I've noticed.
There are some other species that are closely connected to anger. Guilt is one of them. Depression is one. Is a species of kind of anger. It's kind of a kind of frozen or kind of stuck emotion or anger, stuck expression, often. Another one is boredom. Boredom is also a kind of a subtle, stuck aversion that might arise. So it's all really great stuff. And you know, it's already time, but I could talk a lot more about anger, but probably this is enough for one day. Yes.
Sometimes when we can tolerate anger at all, then we dissociate, and that means we're not quite there, you know. Part of it's somewhere else.
It's a protective mechanism to dissociate.
It's a protective mechanism when it gets overwhelming. And that's what I wanted to say to you. And the other thing that I find so difficult to handle with anger, it almost seems a little infectious, you know.
That's a good point.
And
you hear that?
When it comes and it's like, I had all this anger and it almost spilled over, and at the end of the day there was some kind of an agitation and there's kind of left of all this, and I think that's really hard to deal with. You know, in psychiatry we call it projective identification. That, you know, somebody kind of projects all his stuff out and we kind of identify in some ways with it, you know, and then we're going out and we feel relief. I'm a psychiatrist and I think that some of the patients, you know, the condition is just being underprivileged. There is a lot of anger. And when I'm confronted with a lot of it, you know, then I sometimes come home in the evening and I'm agitated, you know. I came home and my roommate had let my cat into a room she shouldn't have, you know, and I felt really this whole thing coming up and feeling underprivileged, you know. So I think that really, it spilled over.
One of the things about when we start studying anger more carefully and we start understanding some of it, the roots of our anger, is it's possible then to let the emotional response to a situation rest at the root before it becomes anger. So if, for example, fear triggers anger, if we really see that and see the fear when it arises, we can learn to kind of keep it at the level of fear and respond to the situation responsibly at just the level of fear, and doesn't have to move into anger. If we feel hurt or feel distressed, there's a tremendous amount of terrible things in our society, in this world. People treat each other terribly, horribly. And it's, you can feel a lot of distress and a lot of pain reading the papers or just talking to some of the people who live in our society who are really suffering because of the injustice that exists. And one of the responses would be to be angry. But the anger itself arises out of the pain that we feel. And if we can just let, it's enough just to feel the pain. It's healthy to feel the pain. And then from the pain, find other responses besides anger. That are, as some people say, well, anger has a purpose because I get all this energy, I can take care of things. That's true. But I think it's also possible to learn as effective ways, as energized ways to take care of things that don't depend on anger to get us energized. And so one of the opportunities that exists is when we understand the roots of the anger, the underlying feeling that's stimulating the anger, we can get that energized response from that rather than from the anger itself. Make sense? Yes?
I know that you say this every time, but what I find the most difficult is not getting involved in the story. It's really hard for me. And you say, well, you know, sit there and feel it. And what I do is I go over it and over and over and over and over. And I'm just mad and hurt and whatever. And it's very hard for me to just know how to do that without telling myself the story over and over. This person was so awful to me, or...
So close your eyes for a moment and recall a time when you were just going over and over a story, over and over and over again, spinning the story. What does it feel like in your head to do that?
Very energized and very chaotic.
Which of those seems most predominant for you?
Energy.
Energy. So where do you feel the energy?
Here.
And what happens when you feel the energy there? Is it difficult to be with that energy?
Yes.
So what makes it difficult?
I'm not sure.
Is there resistance?
Yes.
And where's the resistance?
Where
do you feel the resistance in your body?
Also in my chest.
Huh? So I don't know if you said earlier that, you know, you have a hard time dropping down into the bodily experience of it, but sometimes by feeling, doing what we did now, just feeling the energetics of it, is one way in. Because when your mind is spinning around, spinning around, spinning around, it's actually quite uncomfortable. There's actually a feeling of discomfort, energetic discomfort. And that part of your body, the experience that feels the discomfort, loves to get attention, loves to get the salve of awareness. If you can find what in your experience wants that salve of awakening, then, and so if you're looking too quickly, like you have some idea of what it means to be in your body, you might never find it, but you want to find that part of the experience which is begging for a little massage of awareness. So,
thank
you. So it could just be the energy. Yes?
One of the techniques that I learned at the 10-day retreat that I appreciated very much related to anger was Carol Wilson talking about, rather than doing a walking meditation, doing a stomping meditation. And not so much just to express the anger, but to quick start it, drop the storyline, and feel it.
That's nice.
And it was excellent. And it's something that I listen to what you're saying, and it's just being so calm about the anger. And that's really hard to do if you're actually. So the stomping meditation, for me anyway, was the most effective thing.
That's nice. Thank you for filling that in. And if I'm angry enough, that's what I'll do too. I wouldn't necessarily stomp, but if I'm angry enough, I might not sit. I might just go for a long walk and just kind of, in the walking, kind of let that help me be the open channel to it. Because finding somebody to be open channel to it is so useful. If the sitting doesn't do it, find another way. And what you say is quite nice, by giving enough channel to it, enough expression of it in that kind of way, it helps us kind of not be in the story, perhaps, but allow it to be there fully. And what I hope is that kind of movement is different than catharsis.
No, it's not.
What's the difference?
It's not just, it's not like pounding the pillows. It's different.
Yeah, so tell, what's the difference between that, what you're talking about, and catharsis?
Can it be catharsis, you're asking?
No, no, I think it's very important to see the difference. Because catharsis, for me, is somehow acting on the feelings. The stomping that you're talking about sounds to me more like you're not acting on it, but rather you're just giving space for those energies to move through you.
Right, you're kick-starting them.
Maybe.
Could you say something about practices like forgiveness or loving kindness in relation to working with the anger, or being with the anger? Is it something that might be done in order to make the anger change into something else, or can it be worked with in another way?
Sure. One of the nice things about Nancy's comment and Allison's comment is what you'll get, and if you compare that to what I've already said, is you'll feel a sense is that I have certain predilections for dealing with things in a certain way. And that's just who I am. So you have to kind of, those of you who listen to me a lot, just have to realize that I just have my way, and you have to find your way. Right? So that's the way things have to be always, right? I can't. So my tendency is really to, I tend to be a little bit of a purist around mindfulness, just to really bring mindfulness to bear on something. But sometimes mindfulness itself is not enough, or doesn't really work in certain situations. And then there's other tools that there's a lot of other tools that can be used if mindfulness is not the appropriate one. And one of them is to offer what's called the antidote to anger, to kind of bring that which balances anger. And the practice of loving kindness, metta practice, is in Buddhism is the great balance, the antidote to anger. Sometimes the very traditional instructions when there's a lot of anger is, rather than to be mindful of it, is actually to cultivate the opposite, to cultivate the feelings of love or loving kindness or friendliness. And that's very powerful to do. Forgiveness is also very powerful because forgiveness is the antidote to resentment. Loving kindness is the antidote to anger. And forgiveness is the antidote to frozen anger, which I call resentment. Because forgiveness is, we had a long discussion in the last couple of days at home about forgiveness. I mean, this is maybe another topic. Someone lent me this book called The Sunflower. Some of you know it? It's a Holocaust survivor who survived the camps in Poland. And he didn't know whether he was going to live from one day to the next living in the camps. And a lot of the people around him were being killed and shot and dying. And it was quite awful. But they had to go out on a work duty every day. And one day he was taken into town out of the camps to go work in a German hospital. And they were kind of just doing kind of menial work around the hospital. And a nurse came up to him and said, are you Jewish? Now, that's when German asks you if you're Jewish. You know, it's not such a good thing during the World War II. But he said yes. He said, well, come with me. So he followed this nurse into this patient's room where this one man was by himself. And the only time someone was really by themselves in a room is because they're dying. They put dying patients alone. And he was all bandaged up. And the nurse said, okay, you go. This patient wants to talk to you. And she left the room and closed the door. And the patient was a German officer, an SS officer, who had volunteered for the SS but had reluctantly been involved in a massacre of Jews in Russia. A horrible massacre that he was kind of forced to be part of. And then a couple of days later, he stepped on a Russian mine, and he was terribly maimed. And he was shuttled around different hospitals, and they came to this hospital in Poland, and he was dying. And he was telling the whole story of how his involvement with the massacre, his involvement with the SS, and everything to this Jew, and the Jew didn't want to hear it. He kept wanting to leave, and the guy said, please stay, and he held his hand, and don't leave. So he heard him out, the whole story. And then when he finished his whole story, he said to the Jewish prisoner, please grant me forgiveness. And at this point, the Jewish prisoner turned around and walked out of the room. And then that night, I think the German soldier died. And he was he'd been reflecting on this ever since, this his decision about not to offer forgiveness. And so it's a true story, and he continues telling this a little bit. It's about 60 or 70 pages of story. And then the rest of the book is made up of essays, short essays, by all kinds of interesting people about their reflections on that situation, about whether he should have offered forgiveness or not. So we've had these conversations at home lately, and my mother-in-law who's visiting, she survived Bergen-Belsen. She's a Holocaust survivor also. So to ask her, you know, it was, you know, it's a good person to ask. And the thing that she said a number of things about forgiveness, but my wife said the purpose of we were talking about my mother-in-law couldn't quite understand what forgiveness is, and my wife said that you have to remember that forgiveness is primarily for yourself and not so much for the other person, and for part of what forgiveness is releasing what's frozen inside of you. And so it's for your own sake that you forgive. And that's maybe part of it. And then I said that that for me, forgiveness was a little bit more, but it was actually willing to enter into a relationship of some goodwill again towards the person. It wasn't pardoning them from what they did or ignoring it or excusing it or justifying it. But still, even so, forgiveness is willing to have some kind of expression of goodwill. And my mother-in-law said... you know, she feels that she no longer has any resentment, but she doesn't feel any need to have any goodwill. So that's how. So to Allison's question about, so one of the antidotes to resentment is to do what we call a forgiveness practice, to actually offer forgiveness, realizing that the forgiveness is maybe for ourselves, not necessarily for the other person. So it's a big world of a lot of suffering and a lot of atrocities and a lot of stuff. The world is a tremendously painful place. And one of the ways in which we perpetuate the pain of the world, suffering of the world, is by contributing to, is by being unskillful about our anger. And probably one of the greatest sources for a lot of this world suffering is unskillful expressions of anger. And I think I believe that it's a great gift that we give the world, those of us who are actually study our anger rather than just simply act on it blindly, and to learn how to hold it inside of ourselves, whether it's stopping or in meditation or whatever, but hold it and really feel it, give kind of pure, unjudgmental presence to that feelings. And then from that ability to begin teasing apart really what's going on here, both in ourselves and also in the others, when others are angry, so we can meet them with compassion and caring rather than reactivity. So I think it's a really powerful and wonderful thing to do, and an important thing for us to do. So I hope that tonight's talk is for the benefit of the well-being of many people. Next week, many of those people are coming here. I believe, isn't it next week I do the introductory course?
No.
It's not?
No, you haven't given your ethics talk yet.
I haven't given my ethics talks.
So it can't be.
It can't be. Well, I wasn't going to do ethics this time. But, so it's a 6th or 7th. So I guess there's in 2 weeks. So in 2 weeks, we have introductory course. So next week it's just, you know, more of the same. No, not necessarily. Tonight was ethics.